Good for the blacks. Lincoln proposed sarcastically that the beneficial institution should therefore be extended to whites as well. Then, at the state convention at Springfield, Lincoln gave what is generally agreed as one of the greatest political speeches in American history. We are now far into the fifth year since a policy was initiated with the avowed object and confident promise of putting an end to slavery agitation. That agitation has not ceased, but has constantly augmented. In my opinion, it will not cease until a crisis has been reached and passed. A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the house to fall. But I do expect that it will cease to be divided. He continued to argue that the opponents of slavery would stop its spread, or that the proponents would make it lawful in all states. Sufficiently determined to make slavery the issue, Lincoln engaged Douglas in the pivotal debates, where he boxed in the little giant over the issue of popular sovereignty on the one hand and the Dred Scott decision on the other. Douglas claimed to support both. How was that possible, Lincoln asked, if the Supreme Court said that neither the people nor Congress could exclude slavery, yet Douglas hailed popular sovereignty as letting the people choose? Again, contrary to mythology, Lincoln had not raised an issue Douglas had never considered. As early as 1857, Douglas, noting the paradox, produced an answer. These regulations must necessarily depend entirely upon the will and wishes of the people of the territory, as they can only be prescribed by the local legislatures. What was novel was that Lincoln pounded the question in the debates, forcing Douglas to elaborate further than he already had. Slavery cannot exist a day in the midst of an unfriendly people with unfriendly laws. Without realizing it, and even before this view was immortalized as the Freeport Doctrine, Douglas had stepped into a viper's pit, for he had raised the central fact that slavery was not a cultural or economic institution, but that it was a powerful relationship. In its most crystal form, slavery was political oppression. Yet the question was asked and answered at the debate at Freeport, where Lincoln maneuvered Douglas into a categorical statement. It matters not what way the Supreme Court may decide as to the abstract question of whether slavery may or may not go into a territory. The people have the lawful means to introduce it or exclude it as they please. To fire-eaters in the South, Douglas had just given the people of the territories a legitimate rationale for breaking the national law. He had cut the legs out from under the Dred Scott decision and all but preached rebellion to non-slave owners in the South. Lincoln's aim, however, was not to shatter Douglas's Southern support, as it had no bearing whatsoever on the Senate race at hand. Rather, he had shifted the argument to a different philosophical plane, that of the morality of slavery. Douglas had gone on record as saying that it did not matter if slavery was right or wrong, or even if the Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, was right or wrong. In short, the contest pitted republicanism against democracy in the purest sense of the definition, for Douglas advocated a majoritarian dictatorship in which those with the most votes won regardless of right or wrong. Lincoln, on the other hand, defended a democratic republic in which majority rule was proscribed within the rule of law. Douglas's defenders have argued that he advocated only local sovereignty, and he thought local majorities would be less prone to arbitrary action executed without regard for local interests. America's federal system did emphasize local control, but never at the expense of these truths which the American revolutionaries held as self-evident. The real issue, Lincoln said at the last debate, is the sentiment on the part of one class that looks upon the institution of slavery as a wrong. The Republican Party, he said, looks upon it as being a moral, social, and political wrong, and one of the methods of treating it as a wrong is to make provision that it shall grow no larger. That is the real issue. A moral and social and a political wrong, he called slavery at Quincy in the October debate. Lincoln went further, declaring that the black man was entitled to all the natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, in the right to eat the bread without leave of anybody else which his own hand earns. He is my equal and the equal of Judge Douglas and the equal of every living man. What made Lincoln stand out and gain credibility with the voters was that he embraced the moral and logical designation of slavery as an inherent evil, while distancing himself from the oddball notions of utopian perfectionists like the Grimke sisters or wild-eyed anti-constitutionalists like William Lloyd Garrison. He achieved this by refocusing the nation on slavery's assault on the concept of law in the Republic. Lincoln had already touched on this critical point of respect for the law in his famous 1838 Lyceum Address, in which he attacked both abolitionist rioters and pro-slavery supporters. After predicting that America could never be conquered by a foreign power, Lincoln warned that the danger was from mob law. His remedy for such a threat was simple. Let every American, every lover of liberty, swear by the blood of the Revolution never to violate the least particular laws of the country and never to tolerate their violation by others. Then came the immortal phrase, let reverence for the laws be breathed by every American mother to the lisping babe that prattles on her lap. Let it be taught in schools, in seminaries, and in colleges. Let it be written in the primers, spelling books, and in almanacs. Let it be preached from the pulpit, proclaimed in the legislative halls, and enforced in courts of justice. And, in short, let it become the political religion of the nation. It was inevitable that he would soon see the South as a threat to the foundations of the Republic through its blatant disregard for the law he held so precious. Left-wing historians have attempted to portray Lincoln as a racist because he did not immediately embrace full voting and civil rights for blacks. He had once said, in response to a typical black Republican comment from Stephen Douglas, that just because he did not want a black woman for a slave did not mean he wanted one for a wife. Such comments require consideration of not only their time, but their setting, a political campaign. Applying 21st-century values to earlier times, a historical flaw known as presentism, makes understanding the context of the day even more difficult. On racial issues, Lincoln led, he did not follow. With the exception of a few of the mid-19th-century radicals, who, it must be remembered, used anti-slavery as a means to destroy all social and family relationships of oppression, Lincoln marched far ahead of most of his fellow men when it came to race relations. By the end of the war, despite hostile opposition from his own advisors, he had insisted on paying black soldiers as much as white soldiers. Black editor Frederick Douglass, who had supported a pure abolitionist candidate in the early part of the 1860 election, eventually campaigned for Lincoln and did so again in 1864. They met twice, and Douglas, although never fully satisfied, realized that Lincoln was a friend of his cause. Attending Lincoln's second inaugural, Douglas was banned from the evening gala. When Lincoln heard about it, he issued orders to admit the editor and greeted him warmly. "Here comes my friend Douglas," he said proudly. By the 1850s, slavery had managed to corrupt almost everything it touched, ultimately even giving Abraham Lincoln pause, but only for a brief few years. He was, to his eternal credit, one politician who refused to shirk his duty and to call evil, evil. Virtually alone, Lincoln refused to hide behind obscure phrases, as Madison had, or to take high-minded public positions, as had Jefferson, while personally engaging in the sin. Lincoln continually placed before the public a moral choice that it had to make. Although he spoke on tariffs, temperance, railroads, banks, and many other issues, Lincoln perceived that slavery alone produced a giant contradiction that transcended all sectional issues, that it put at risk both liberty and equality for all races, not just equality as is often presumed. He perceived politically that the time soon approached when a Northern man of Northern principles would be elected president, and through his appointment power could name federal judges to positions in the South where they would rule in favor of runaway slaves, uphold slaves' rights to bring suits or to marry, and otherwise undermine the awful institution. Lincoln, again nearly alone, understood that the central threat to the Republic posed by slavery lay in its corruption of the law. It is to that aspect of the impending crisis that we now turn. The crisis of law and order. Questions such as those posed by Lincoln in the debates, or similar thoughts, weighed heavily on the minds of an increasing number of Americans, North and South. In the short term, Douglas and the Buchanan Democrats in Illinois received enough votes to elect 46 Democratic legislators, while the Republicans elected 41. Douglas retained his seat. In an ominous sign for the Democrats, though, the Republicans won the popular vote. Looking back from a vantage point of more than 140 years, it is easy to see that Douglas's victory was costly and that Lincoln's defeat merely set the stage for his presidential race in 1860. At the time, however, the biggest losers appeared to be James Buchanan, whose support of Lecompton had been picked clean by Douglas's Freeport Doctrine, and Abraham Lincoln, who now had gone 10 years without holding an elected office. But the points made by Lincoln and his repeated emphasis on slavery as a moral evil on the one hand and the law as a moral good on the other soon took hold of a growing share of public opinion. Equally important, Douglas had been forced into undercutting Dred Scott, had swung the pendulum back away from the South yet again. This swing, destroying as it did the guts of the Supreme Court's ruling, took on a more ominous tone with John Brown's Harper's Ferry raid in October 1859. John Brown illustrated exactly what Lincoln meant about respect for the laws and the likelihood that violence would destroy the nation if Congress or the courts could not put slavery on a course to extinction. Lincoln, who had returned to his legal work before the Urbana Circuit Court, despised Brown's vigilantism. Mob riots in St. Louis had inspired his Lyceum Address, and although Lincoln thought Brown courageous and thoughtful, he also thought him a criminal. Brown's raid, Lincoln observed, represented a continuing breakdown in law and order spawned by the degrading of the law in the hands of the slave states. More disorder followed, but of a different type. When the 35th Congress met in December, only 3 days after Brown had dangled at the end of a rope, it split as sharply as the rest of the nation. The Capitol building, in which the legislators gathered, had nearly assumed its modern form after major construction and remodeling between 1851 and 1858. The physical edifice grew in strength and grandeur at the same time that the invisible organs and blood that gave it life, the political parties, seemed to crumble more each day. Democrats held the Senate, but in the House, the Republicans had 109 votes and the Democrats 101. To confuse matters even more than 10% of the Democrats refused to support any pro-slavery Southerner. Then there were the 27 pro-slavery Whigs who could have held the balance, but wishing not to be cut out of any committees, treaded carefully. When the election for Speaker of the House took place, it became clear how far down the path of disunion the nation had wandered. It took 119 votes to elect a Speaker, but once the procedures started, it became obvious that the Southern legislators did not want to elect a speaker at all, but to shut down the federal government. Acrimony characterized floor speeches, and Senator James Hammond quipped that, "The only persons who do not have a revolver and a knife are those who have two revolvers." Republicans wanted John Sherman of Ohio, whereas the fragmented Democrats continued to self-destruct, splitting over John McClernand of Illinois and Thomas Bocock of Virginia. Ultimately, Sherman withdrew in favor of a man who had recently converted from the Whig Party to the Republican, William Pennington of New Jersey, widely viewed as a weak, if not incompetent, speaker. He won just enough votes for election thanks to a few Southerners who supported him because of his strong stand in favor of the fugitive slave law 8 years earlier. It would not be long until Congress either shut down entirely or operated with utterly maladroit, ineffectual, and politically disabled men at the top. At the very moment when, to save slavery, the South should have mended fences with discordant Northern Democrats, many Southerners searched frantically for a litmus test that would force a vote on some aspect of slavery. This mandatory allegiance marked the final inversion of Van Buren's grand scheme to keep slavery out of the national debate by creating a political party. Now, some in the Democratic Party combed legislative options as a means to bring some aspect of slavery, any aspect, up for a vote in order to legitimize it once and for all. Their quest led them to argue for reopening the African slave trade. Leading Southern thinkers analyzed the moral problem of a ban on the slave trade. If it was right to buy slaves in Virginia and carry them to New Orleans, why is it not right to buy them in Africa and carry them here? Asked William Yancey. Lincoln might have reversed the question. If it is wrong to enslave free people in Africa and bring them to Virginia, why is it acceptable to keep slaves in either Virginia or New Orleans? In fact, 90% of Southerners, according to Hammond's estimate, disapproved of reopening the slave trade, reasoning that slaves already here were content and that the blacks in Africa were cannibals, according to one writer, provided a suitable psychological salve that prevented Southerners from dealing with the contradictions of their views. Debates over reopening the slave trade intensified after the case of the Wanderer, a 114-foot vessel launched in 1857 from Long Island that had docked in Savannah, where it was purchased through a secret deal in New York by Southern cotton trader Charles A.L. Lamar. The new owner made suspicious changes to the ship's structure before sailing to Southern ports. From Charleston, the Wanderer headed for Africa, where the captain purchased 600 slaves and again turned back to the south, specifically a spot near Jekyll Island, Georgia. By that time, only about 300 of the slaves had survived the voyage and disease, and when rumors of the arrivals of new slaves circulated, a Savannah federal marshal started an investigation. Eventually, the ship was seized and Lamar indicted and tried. During the court proceedings, it became clear how thick the cloud of obfuscation and deceit was in Southern courts when it came to legal actions against slavery. Judges stalled, no one went to trial, and even the grand jurors who had found the indictments in the first place publicly recanted. And in the ultimate display of the corruption of the legal system in the South, Lamar was the only bidder on the appropriated Wanderer when it was put up for auction, announcing that the episode had given him good experience in the slave trade that he would apply in the future. Federal officials realized from the case of the Wanderer and a few other similar cases that no Southern court would ever enforce any federal anti-slavery laws, and that no law of the land would carry any weight in the South if it in any way diminished slaveholding. Lamar had lost most of his investment. More than two-thirds of the slaves died either en route or after arrival, but the precedent of renewing the slave trade was significant. It was in this context that the Civil War began. Two sections of the nation, one committed to the perpetual continuation of slavery, one committed to its eventual extinction, could debate, compromise, legislate, and judge, but ultimately they disagreed over an issue that had such moral weight that one view or the other had to triumph. Their inability to find an amicable solution gives lie to the modern notions that all serious differences can yield to better communication and diplomacy. But, of course, Lincoln had predicted exactly this result. Chapter 9. The Crisis of the Union, 1860-65. Lurching toward war. Despite a remarkable and often unimaginable growth spurt in the first half of the 19th century, and despite advances in communication and transportation, all given as solutions to war and conflict, the nation nevertheless lumbered almost inexorably toward a final definitive split. No amount of prosperity and no level of communication could address, ameliorate, or cover up the problem of slavery and the Republicans' response to it. No impassioned appeals, no impeccable logic, and no patriotic innovations of union could overcome the fact that by 1860, more than half of all Americans thought slavery morally wrong, and a large plurality thought it so destructive that it had to be ended at any cost. Nor could sound reasoning or invocations of divine scripture dissuade the South from the conviction that the election of any Republican meant an instant attack on the institution of slavery. What made war irrepressible and impending in the minds of many was that the political structure developed with the Second American Party system relied on the continuation of two key factors that were neither desirable nor possible to sustain. One was a small federal government content to leave the states to their own devices. On some matters, this was laudable, not to mention constitutional. On others, however, it permitted the South to maintain and perpetuate slavery. Any shift in power between the federal government and the states, therefore, specifically threatened the Southern slaveholders more than any other group, for it was their constitutional right to property that stood in conflict with the constitutional right of due process for all Americans, not to mention the Declaration's promise that all men are created equal. The other factor, closely tied to the first, was that the South, tossed amid the tempest and lacking electoral power, found itself lashed to the presidential mast requiring a Northern man of Southern principles. That mast snapped in November 1860, and with it the nation was drawn into a maelstrom. Timeline: 1860, Lincoln elected president. South Carolina secedes. 1861, Lower South secedes and founds the Confederacy. Lincoln and Davis inaugurated. Fort Sumter surrenders to the Confederacy. Upper South secedes from the Union. Battle of Bull Run. 1862, Battles of Shiloh, Antietam, and Fredericksburg. Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. 1863, Emancipation Proclamation. Battles of Vicksburg and Gettysburg. 1864, Fall of Atlanta and Sherman's March to the Sea. Lincoln reelected. 1865, 13th Amendment passed by Congress. Lee surrenders to Grant at Appomattox. Lincoln assassinated. Johnson assumes presidency. America's Pivotal Election, 1860. The Electoral College and not a majority of voters elected the new president. For the South, based on the experience of 1848 and the near election of John Fremont in 1856, it was a good thing. Since 1840, the numbers had been running against slavery. The choice of electors for the Electoral College was made by a general election in which each state received electors equal to the number of its congressional and senatorial delegations combined. Generally speaking, states gave their electoral total to whichever candidate won the general election in its state, even if only by a plurality. As has been seen several times, this form of election meant that a candidate could win the popular vote nationally and still lose the Electoral College, or, because of third parties, win a narrow plurality in the popular vote, yet carry a large majority in the Electoral College. By 1860, two critical changes had occurred in this process. First, the two major parties, the Democrats and Republicans, held national conventions to nominate their candidates. Because of the absence of primaries, which are common today, the conventions truly did select the candidate, often brokering a winner from among several competing groups. After state legislatures ceased choosing the individual electors, the impetus of this system virtually guaranteed that presidential contests would be two-party affairs, since a vote for a third-party candidate as a protest was a wasted vote, and, from the perspective of the protester, ensured that the least desirable of the candidates won. When several parties competed, as in 1856, the race still broke down into separate two-candidate races, Buchanan versus Fremont in the North and Buchanan versus Fillmore in the South. Second, Van Buren's party structure downplayed and even ignored ideology and instead attempted to enforce party discipline through the spoils system. That worked as long as the party leaders selected the candidates, conducted most of the campaigning, and did everything except mark the ballot for the voters. After 30 years, however, party discipline had crumbled almost entirely because of ideology, specifically the party's different views of slavery. The Republicans, with their anti-slavery positions, took advantage of that and reveled in their sectional appeal. But the Democrats, given the smaller voting population in the South, still needed Northern votes to win. They could not afford to alienate either pro-slavery or free soil advocates. In short, any pro-slavery nominee the Democrats put forward would not receive many, if any, Northern votes, but any Democratic free soil candidate would be shunned in the South, marking the final implosion of the scaffold Van Buren had created to protect slavery nearly 40 years earlier. With this dynamic in mind, the Democrats met in April 1860 in Charleston, South Carolina. It was hot outside the meeting rooms and hotter inside, given the friction of the pro- and anti-slavery delegates stuffed into the inadequately sized halls. Charleston, which would soon be ground zero for the insurrection, was no place for conciliators. And, sensibly, the delegates agreed to adjourn and meet 6 weeks later in Baltimore. Stephen Douglas should have controlled the convention. He had a majority of the votes, but the party's rules required a two-thirds majority to nominate. Southern delegates arrived in Baltimore with the intention of demanding that Congress pass a national slave code legitimizing slavery and overtly making Northerners partners in crime. Ominously, just before the convention opened, delegates from seven states announced that they would walk out if Douglas received the nomination. Northern Democrats, needing a wake-up call to the intentions of the South, had only to listen to the speech of William L. Yancey of Alabama, who berated Northerners for accepting the view that slavery was evil. On the surface, disagreements appeared to center on the territories and the protection of slavery there. Southerners wanted a clear statement that the federal government would protect property rights in slaves, whereas the Douglas wing wanted a loose interpretation allowing the courts and Congress authority over the territories. A vote on the majority report declaring a federal obligation to protect slavery failed, whereupon some Southern delegates, true to their word, walked out. After Douglas's forces attempted to have new pro-Douglas delegations formed that would give him the nomination, other Southern delegations from Virginia, North Carolina, and Tennessee also departed. Remaining delegates finally handed Douglas the nomination, leaving him with a hollow victory in the knowledge that the South would hold its own convention and find a candidate, John Breckinridge of Kentucky, to run against him, further diluting his vote. Where did sensible, moderate Southerners go? Many of them gravitated to the comatose Whigs, who suddenly stirred. Seeing an opportunity to revive nationally as a middle way, the Whigs reorganized under the banner of the Union Party. But when it came to actually nominating a person, the choices were bleak, and the candidates universally old. Winfield Scott, 74, Sam Houston, 67, and John J. Crittenden, 74. The Constitutional Union Party finally nominated 64-year-old John Bell, a Tennessee slaveholder who had voted against the Kansas-Nebraska Act. The Republicans, beaming with optimism, met in Chicago at a hall called the Wigwam. They needed only to hold what Fremont had won in 1856 and gain Pennsylvania and one other northern state from among Illinois, Indiana, and New Jersey. William H. Seward, former governor of New York and one of that state's U.S. senators, was their frontrunner. Already famous in anti-slavery circles for his fiery "higher law" and "irrepressible conflict" speeches, Seward surprised the delegates with a Senate address calling for moderation and peaceful coexistence. Seward's unexpected move toward the middle opened the door for Abraham Lincoln to stake out the more radical position. Yet the Republicans retreated from their inflammatory language of 1856. There was no reference to the twin relics of barbarism, slavery, and polygamy, which had characterized Fremont's campaign in 1856. The delegates denounced the Harper's Ferry raid, but the most frequently used word at the Republican convention, solemn, contrasted sharply with the Charleston convention's repeated use of crisis. Despite his recent moderation, Seward still had the irrepressible conflict baggage tied around him, and doubts lingered as to whether he could carry any of the key states that Fremont had lost 4 years earlier. Lincoln, on the other hand, was from Illinois, although he went to the convention the darkest of dark horses. His name was not even listed in a booklet providing brief biographies of the major candidates for the nomination. He gained the party's nod largely because of some brilliant backstage maneuvering by his managers and the growing realization by the delegates that he, not Seward, was likely to carry the battleground states. When Abraham Lincoln emerged with the Republican nomination, he entered an unusual four-way race against Douglas, Northern Democrat, Bell, Constitutional Union, and Breckinridge, Southern Democrat. Of the four, only Lincoln stood squarely against slavery, and only Lincoln favored the tariff, which may have swung the election in Pennsylvania, and the Homestead Act, which certainly helped carry parts of the Midwest. As in 1856, the race broke down into sectional contests, pitting Lincoln against Douglas in the north and Bell against Breckinridge in the south. Lincoln's task was the most difficult of the four in that he had to win outright, lacking the necessary support in the House of Representatives. The unusual alignments meant that the United States was holding two elections simultaneously on November 6, 1860, one between Lincoln and Douglas and a second between Breckinridge and Bell. On Election Day, Douglas learned from the Telegraph that he had been crushed in New York and Pennsylvania. More sobering was the editorial in the Atlanta Confederacy, predicting Lincoln's inauguration would result in the Potomac's being crimsoned in human gore, sweeping the last vestige of liberty from the American continent. When the votes were counted, Lincoln had carried all the northern states except New Jersey, where he split the electoral vote with Douglas, as well as Oregon and California, for a total of 160 electoral votes. Douglas, despite winning nearly 30% of the popular vote, took only Missouri and part of New Jersey. This was a stunning disappointment, even though he had known the southern vote would abandon him. Breckinridge carried the Deep South and Maryland. Only Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky went to Bell, whose 39 electoral votes exceeded those of Douglas. The popular vote could be interpreted many ways. Lincoln received more than 1.86 million votes, almost 40%, followed by Douglas with 1.38 million. Lincoln did not receive a single recorded vote in 10 slave states, but won every free state except New Jersey. If one adds Lincoln's and Douglas's popular vote totals together, applying the South's faulty logic that Douglas was a free soiler, almost 69% voted against slavery. And even if one generously and inaccurately lumps together the votes for Bell and Breckinridge, the best case that the South could make was that it had the support of no more than 31% of the voters. The handwriting was on the wall. Slavery in America was on the road to extinction. The key was that Lincoln did not need the South. When this realization dawned on Southerners, it was a shocking comeuppance, for since the founding of the nation, a Southern slaveholder had held the office of president for 49 out of 72 years, or better than two-thirds of the time. 24 of the 36 speakers of the House and 25 of the 36 presidents pro tem of the Senate had been Southerners. 20 of the 35 Supreme Court justices had come from slave states, giving them a majority on the court at all times. After the election, Lincoln found his greatest ally in preserving the Union in his defeated foe, Stephen Douglas. The Illinois senator threw the full force of his statesmanship behind the cause of the Union. His and Lincoln's efforts were for naught, since the South marched headlong toward secession. Southern states recognized that it would only be a matter of months until a black Republican would have control over patronage, customs officials in Southern states, and federal contracts. A black Republican attorney general would supervise federal marshals in Mississippi and Louisiana, while Republican postmasters would have authority over the mails that streamed into Alabama and Georgia. Black Republicans with purposes hostile to slavery, the South Carolina Secession Convention noted. The last uneasy months of Union. Democrat President James Buchanan presided over a nation rapidly unraveling, leading him to welcome emergency measures that would avoid a war. Lincoln agreed to a proposed constitutional amendment that would prohibit interference with slavery in states where it existed. Congress now attempted to do in a month what it had been unable to do in more than 40 years, find a compromise to the problem of slavery. In mid-December, Kentuckian John J. Crittenden, a respected Senate leader, submitted an omnibus set of proposals which were supported by the Committee of 13, politicians who could have averted war had they so chosen, including Jefferson Davis, Seward, Douglas, and from the House, a rising star, Charles Francis Adams. Crittenden's resolutions proposed four compromise measures. First, they would restore the Missouri Compromise line. Second, prohibit the abolition of slaveholding on federal property in the South. Third, establish compensation for owners of runaways. And last, repeal personal liberty laws in the North. More important, the compromise would insert the word slavery in the Constitution and then repackage the guarantees with a constitutional guarantee that would make the provisions inviolate to future change. By that time, the North held the decision for war in its hands. Given that the South was bent on violating the Constitution no matter what, Northerners glumly realized that only one of three options remained: war, compromise, or allowing the Deep South to leave. Since no compromise would satisfy the South, Northerners soberly assessed the benefits of allowing the slaveholding states to depart. The money markets already had plunged because of the turmoil, adding to the national anxiety. Northerners desperately wanted to avoid disunion, and had the Crittenden proposals been put to a national plebiscite, it is probable they would have passed, according to Horace Greeley, although the secessionists would have ignored them as well. But in Congress, the measures died. Republicans never cast a single vote for the provisions, and more important, the South could not accede to any of the conditions. Now, truly, the issue was on the table. Would slavery survive without the support of the people? Would a majority of Southerners long support the slaveholding elites if federal law opened up its mails and harbors? Answers came shortly when a new government formed in the South. The Confederate States of America. No sooner had the telegraphs stopped clattering with the 1860 electoral counts than Robert Barnwell Rhett, William Yancey, T.R. Cobb, and other Southern fire-eaters led a movement to call the state governments of the Deep South into session. South Carolina, Alabama, and Mississippi met first, the legislators in Columbia, South Carolina, ablaze with secessionist rhetoric. American flags were ripped down, replaced by new South Carolina secesh flags of a red star on a white background. The Palmetto State's incendiary voices hardly surpassed those in Alabama, where the secession proposal had early widespread support. Virginian Edmund Ruffin, one of the hottest fire eaters, had outlined a League of United Southerners in 1858, and the commercial conventions in 1858 advanced the notion still further. On November 10, 1860, the South Carolina legislature announced a convention to occur a month later. If necessary, South Carolina was ready to act unilaterally. Florida, Alabama, and Georgia announced similar conventions. Every stop of the way, South Carolina took the lead, issuing an address to the people of South Carolina that called the Constitution of the United States a failed experiment. Rhett proposed a conference in Montgomery with other southern states to form a government separate from the United States, and South Carolina officially seceded on December 20, 1860. Stephen Douglas lambasted the movement as an enormous conspiracy formed by the leaders of the secession movement 12 months ago. Fire eaters, he said, manipulated the election in order to have caused a man to be elected by a sectional vote, thereby proving that the Union was as divided as they claimed. However, evidence paints a more complex picture. In many of the southern states, the vote on secession was quite close. In Mississippi, for example, the secessionists defeated the cooperationists by fewer than 5,000 votes. January's secession conventions in other states produced even smaller pro-secession margins. Secession carried in Georgia by 3,500 ballots, and in Louisiana by 1,200. Nowhere in the South did the vote on secession approximate the numbers who had gone to the polls for the presidential election. Only 70% of the November total turned out in Alabama, 75% in Louisiana, and only 60% in Mississippi, making the pro-secession vote even less of a mandate. After the war started, the large number of troops that the South furnished to the Union, often ignored or neglected by historians, also painted a picture of a population divided. Alabama put 2,500 troops in Union blue, Virginia 32,000, Tennessee 31,000, Arkansas 8,000, Louisiana 5,000, and North Carolina 3,000. All told, the Confederate states sent more than 100,000 whites, not to mention runaway slaves, who donned federal colors. Nevertheless, Douglas's conspiracy interpretation did not account for the fact that the secession forces won the elections, no matter how narrowly and no matter how light the vote, underscoring the old adage that all that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing, or in the case of an election, stay home. More important, the winner-take-all system led to a unanimous agreement by the states of the Lower South to send delegates to a February convention in Montgomery. As an Alabamian put it, "We are no longer one people. A paper parchment is all that holds us together, and the sooner that bond is severed, the better it will be for both parties." In fact, secession had been railroaded through even more forcefully than the final state convention votes suggested. There was no popular referendum anywhere in the South. Conventions made up of delegates selected by the legislatures elected 854 men, 157 of whom voted against secession. Put in the starkest terms, some 697 men, mostly wealthy, decided the destiny of 9 million people, mostly poor, and one-third enslaved. The circumstances of secession thus lend some credence to the position that when war finally came, many Southerners fought out of duty to their state, and indeed many saw themselves as upholding constitutional principles. Few believed they were fighting to protect or perpetuate slavery per se. Given the conception of citizenship at the time, in the North and South, wherein rights originated in the state, not the federal government, most Southerners normally would have sided with their state government in a fracas against the national government. On February 7, 1861, the Montgomery delegates adopted a new constitution for the Confederate States of America, and 2 days later elected Jefferson Davis of Mississippi as the CSA's first president. Davis looked much like Lincoln, and had he worn a beard, from certain angles they would have been indistinguishable. Like Lincoln, he had served in the Black Hawk War, then saw combat at both Monterey and Buena Vista under Zachary Taylor. Like Lincoln, Davis knew heartache. He had married Taylor's daughter, who died of malaria. Davis differed from his northern counterpart in many ways, though. He lived on a small estate given to him by his brother, but he never achieved the wealthy planter lifestyle of other Confederate spokesmen. His view of slavery was based on how he personally treated his slaves, which was well. Thus, the abominations perpetrated by other masters seemed pure fantasy to Davis, who did not travel extensively. Debates over issues became assaults on his personal honor, leading him to give short shrift to the advice of moderates. An advocate of industrialism and manufacturing, Davis shared with other Southern commercial messengers a blind spot for the dampening effects of slavery on investment and entrepreneurship. Quite simply, most entrepreneurs steered clear of a slave system that stifled free speech, oppressed one-third of its consumers, and co-opted the personal liberty of free men to enforce slavery. Although Davis once criticized the brainless intemperance of those who wanted disunion, his own secessionist utterances bordered on hysterical, earning him from the New York Herald the nickname Mephistopheles of the South. When secession came, he had an office in mind, general-in-chief of the new army. He scarcely dreamed he would be president. The new Confederate Constitution over which Jefferson Davis presided prohibited tariffs, subsidies to businesses, and most taxation, and required that all appropriations bills be passed by a two-thirds majority. This seemed on the surface quite Jeffersonian. Other provisions were not so Jeffersonian. The CSA Constitution granted de facto subsidies to slave owners through externalized costs, passed off on all non-slaveholders the enforcement expenses of slavery, such as paying posses and court costs. And the Constitution ensured that censorship would only get worse. Although there was a provision for a Supreme Court, the Confederate Congress never established one, and the court system that existed tended to support the centralized power of the Confederate government rather than restrict it. Certainly, there was no check on the Congress or the President from compliant courts. As would become clear during the war, the absence of such checks in the Confederate Constitution gave Davis virtually unlimited power, including a line-item veto. The document reflected in many ways a Southern abstraction of what differentiated the sections of the Union. Southern ideals of what secession entailed sprang from three main sources. First, during the past decade, Southerners had come to hate free soil concepts, finding them deeply offensive not only to the cotton economy to which they were committed, but to the system of white superiority ingrained in the culture of the South. This had produced, no matter how unintended, a dismissive and patronizing attitude toward small, non-slave-owning landholders. It also severely retarded inventiveness and innovation, contributing to an overall lack of scientific inquisitiveness in the South. Second, a residual notion of states' rights from the days of the Anti-Federalists, nurtured by such thinkers as George Mason and John Calhoun, had gained popularity in the 1850s. The sovereignty of the states over the Union had a mixed and contradictory record of support by leading Southerners, including Jefferson and Jackson. Under the Confederacy, the principle of states' rights emerged unfettered and triumphant. The third was the widespread and deeply flawed view of the propagandists of the South that cotton is king, and that a Southern republic would not only be freer, but economically superior to the North. Demonizing Northerners followed in short order. New Englanders were meddlers, jailbirds, outlaws, and disturbers of the peace. There had to be some irony involved in the labeling of former Puritans as jailbirds and outlaws by a region that prided itself on its frontier violence and, in the case of Georgia, had had felons as its first settlers. Outright lies about Lincoln's intentions occurred with regularity in order to put the citizens of the new republic in the proper frame of mind. Indeed, Lincoln's promise not to touch slavery where it already existed only irritated the fire-eaters more, exposing as it did their ultimate fear, that without expansion the South would only become darker. Being unable to transport slaves into the territories, as Senator Robert Johnson of Arkansas pointed out, would increase the population inequities because of the natural multiplication of colored people, until blacks became equal in numbers to whites, then exceeded them. At that point, a race war would ensue. Despite 30 years of philosophizing, denials, obfuscation, scriptural revision, and constitutional sophistries, it all came down to this. The South was terrified of large numbers of blacks, slave or free. It is not an exaggeration to say that the Civil War was about slavery and, in the long run, only about slavery. If anyone doubted the relative importance of slavery versus states' rights in the Confederacy, one only had to look at those clauses in the CSA's Constitution that expressly said, in Article 1, Section 8, Number 4, "No bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law denying or impairing the right of property in Negro slaves shall be passed." Article 4, Section 2 stated that "the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all the privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states, and shall have the right of transit and sojourn in any state of this Confederacy with their slaves and other property, and the right of property in said slaves shall not be thereby impaired." Yet a third specific reference to slavery in Section 3 of the same article stipulated that any escaped slave or slave lawfully carried into another state could be discharged from service or labor, but had to be returned to the owner. In all future territories acquired by the CSA, the institution of Negro slavery as it now exists in the Confederate States shall be recognized and protected by Congress and by the territorial government. And all inhabitants of the Confederacy could take their slaves with them lawfully into any Confederate territory. No wonder CSA Vice President Alexander H. Stephens of Georgia made matters plain. "Our new government is founded upon the great truth that the Negro is not the equal of the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition." Stevens called slavery the proper status of the Negro in our form of civilization. In contradiction to libertarian references to states' rights and liberty made by many modern neo-Confederates, the rebel leadership made clear its view that not only were blacks not people, but that ultimately all blacks, including then-free Negroes, should be enslaved. In his response to the Emancipation Proclamation, Jefferson Davis stated, "On or after February 22, 1863, all free Negroes within the limits of the Southern Confederacy shall be placed on slave status and be deemed to be chattels, they and their issue forever." Not only blacks within the limits of the Confederacy, but "all Negroes who shall be taken in any of the states in which slavery does not now exist, in the progress of our arms shall be adjudged to occupy the slave status, and all free Negroes shall, ipso facto, be reduced to the condition of helotism, so that the white and black races may be ultimately placed on a permanent basis," Italics added. That basis, Davis said after the war started, was as an inferior race, peaceful and contented laborers in their sphere. Fort Sumter. By the time Lincoln had actually taken the reins of the United States government in March 1861, the Deep South had seceded. Although Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas, and others still remained in the Union, their membership was tenuous. From November 1860 until March 1861, James Buchanan still hoped to avoid a crisis. But his own cabinet was divided, and far from appearing diplomatic, Buchanan seemed paralyzed. He privately spoke of a constitutional convention that might save the Union, hoping that anything that stalled for time might diffuse the situation. He was right in one thing: the crisis clock was ticking. Secessionists immediately used state troops to grab federal post offices, customs houses, arsenals, and even the New Orleans Mint, which netted the CSA $500,000 in gold and silver. Federal officials resigned or switched sides. Only a few forts, including Fort Moultrie and Fort Sumter, both in Charleston, possessed sufficient troops to dissuade an immediate seizure by the Confederates, but their supplies were limited. Buchanan sent the unarmed Star of the West to reprovision Fort Sumter, only to have South Carolina's shore batteries chase it off. Thus, even before the firing on Fort Sumter itself, the war was on, and whatever effectiveness Little Buchanan, as Teddy Roosevelt later called him, might have had, had evaporated. The leading Democrat in his cabinet, Lewis Cass, resigned in disgust, and Northerners of all political stripes insisted on retaliation. Ignoring calls from his own generals to reinforce the Charleston forts, Buchanan hesitated. His subordinate, Major Robert Anderson, did not. At Fort Sumter, Anderson and 70 Union soldiers faced South Carolina's forces. Fort Moultrie on Sullivan's Island and Fort Johnson on James Island straddled Sumter on each side, which sat in the middle of Charleston Harbor. Fort Johnson was already in Southern hands, but Moultrie held out. Because Anderson could not defend both Moultrie and Sumter, he was forced to relocate his troops to Fort Sumter, transferring them on the night of December 26th. This bought Buchanan time, for he thought keeping the remaining states in the Union held the keys to success. After February 1st, no other southern state had bolted, indicating to Buchanan that compromise remained a possibility. Upon assuming office, Lincoln wasted no time in assessing the situation. After receiving mixed advice from his new cabinet, the president opted to resupply the post, as he put it, to hold and occupy all federal property. He had actually at first thought to reclaim federal territory in Confederate hands, but at the urging of a friend, struck the clause from his inaugural address. He further made clear to the rebels that he would only resupply Anderson, not bring in additional forces. Nevertheless, the inaugural declared that both universal law and the Constitution made the union of these states perpetual. No state could simply leave. The Articles of Secession were null and void. He did hold out the olive branch one last time, offering to take under advisement federal appointees unacceptable to the South. Lincoln did not mince words when it came to any hostilities that might arise. "You can have no conflict without being yourselves the aggressors. We are not enemies," he reminded them, "but friends, the mystic cords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. Lincoln's cabinet opposed reprovisioning Sumter. Most of their opinions could be dismissed, but not those of William Seward, the Secretary of State. Still smarting from the Republican convention, Seward connived almost immediately to undercut Lincoln and perhaps obtain by stealth what he could not gain by ballot. He struck at a time in late March 1861 when Lincoln was absorbed by war and suffering from powerful migraine headaches, leading to unusual eruptions of temper in the generally mild-mannered president. At that point of weakness, Seward moved, presenting Lincoln with a memorandum audaciously recommending that he, Seward, take over, and, more absurdly, that the Union provoke a war with Spain and France. Not only did the secretary criticize the new president for an absence of policy direction, but suggested that as soon as Lincoln surrendered power, Seward would use the war he drummed up with the Europeans as a pretext to dispatch agents to Canada, Mexico, and Central America to rouse a vigorous continental spirit of independence against the Confederacy. The president ignored this impertinence and quietly reminded Seward that he had spelled out his policies in the inaugural address and that Seward himself had supported the reprovisioning of Fort Sumter. Then he made a mental note to keep a sharp eye on his scheming Secretary of State. By April 6th, Lincoln had concluded that the government must make an effort to hold Sumter. He dispatched a messenger to the governor of South Carolina, informing him that Sumter would be reprovisioned with food and supplies only. 4 days later, General P.G.T. Beauregard got orders from Montgomery instructing him to demand that federal troops abandon the fort. On April 12th, Edmund Ruffin, the South Carolina fire-eater who had done as much to bring about the war as anyone, had the honor of firing the first shot of the Civil War. In the ensuing brief artillery exchange in which Beauregard outgunned Anderson, his former West Point superior, 4-1, no one was killed. A day later, Anderson surrendered, leading Jefferson Davis to quip optimistically, "There has been no blood spilled more precious than that of a mule." Soon thereafter, the Upper South joined the Confederacy, as did the Indian Territory tribes, including some of the Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Creek, and Seminole. Lincoln expected as much. He knew, however, that victory resided not in the state houses of Richmond or Little Rock, but in Missouri, Maryland, Kentucky, and Western Virginia. Each of these border states or regions had slaves, but also held strong pro-Union views. Kentucky's critical position as a jumping-off point for a possible invasion of Ohio by Confederates and as a perfect staging ground for a Union invasion of Tennessee was so important that Lincoln once remarked, "I'd like to have God on my side, but I've got to have Kentucky." With long-standing commercial and political ties to the North, Kentucky nevertheless remained a hotbed of pro-slavery sentiment. Governor Beriah Magoffin initially refused calls for troops from both Lincoln and Davis and declared neutrality. But Yankee forces under Grant ensured Kentucky's allegiance to the Union, although Kentucky Confederates simultaneously organized their own counter-government. Militias of the Kentucky State Guard, Union, and Kentucky Home Guard, Confederate, squared off in warfare that quite literally pitted brother against brother. Maryland was equally important because a Confederate Maryland would leave Washington, D.C. surrounded by enemies. Lincoln prevented Maryland's pro-slavery forces, approximately one-third of the populace, from joining the Confederacy by sending in the army. The mere sight of Union troops marching through Maryland to garrison Washington had its effect. Although New York regiments expected trouble, the governor of New York warned that the first Zouaves would go through Baltimore like a dose of salts. In fact, a wide belt of secure pro-Union territory was carved 20 miles across Maryland. Rioting and looting in Baltimore were met by suspension of habeas corpus laws, allowing military governors to keep troublemakers incarcerated indefinitely, and by the arrest of Maryland fire eaters, including 19 state legislators. When General Benjamin Beast Butler marched 1,000 men to seize arms readied for the Confederates and to occupy Federal Hill overlooking Baltimore during a thunderstorm, Maryland's opportunity for secession vanished. One of those firebrands arrested under the suspension of habeas corpus, John Merryman, challenged his arrest. His case went to the U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice and Marylander Democrat Roger Taney, who sat as a circuit judge. Taney, seeing his opportunity to derail the Union's agenda, declared Lincoln's actions unconstitutional. Imitating Jackson in 1832, Lincoln simply ignored the Chief Justice. In Western Virginia, the story was different. Large pockets of Union support existed throughout the southern Appalachian Mountains. In Morgantown, the grievances that the Westerners in Virginia felt toward Richmond exceeded those suffered by the Tidewater planters who were against the Union. A certain degree of reality also set in. Wheeling was susceptible immediately to a bombardment from Ohio, and forces could converge from Pittsburgh and Cincinnati to crush any rebellion there. Wisely, then, on June 19, 1861, Western Unionists voted in a special convention declaring theirs the only legitimate government of Virginia, and the following June, West Virginia became a new Union state. "Let us save Virginia and then save the Union," proclaimed the delegates to the West Virginia Statehood Convention. And then, as if to underscore that it was the restored government of Virginia, the new state adopted the seal of the Commonwealth of Virginia, with the phrase "Liberty and Union" added. West Virginia's defection to the Union buffered Ohio and western Pennsylvania from invasion the same way that keeping Kentucky's geographical location protected Ohio. In a few politically masterful strokes, Lincoln had succeeded in retaining the border states he needed. The North had secured the upper Chesapeake, the entire western section of Virginia. More important, it held strategic inroads into Virginia through the Shenandoah Valley, into Mississippi and Louisiana through Kentucky and Missouri, and into Georgia through the exposed position of the Confederates in Tennessee. Moreover, the populations of the border states, though divided, still favored the Union, and three times as many white Missourians would fight for the Union as for the Confederacy, twice as many Marylanders, and half again as many Kentuckians. Missouri's divided populace bred some of the most violent strife in the border regions. Missourians had literally been at war since 1856 on the Kansas border, and Confederates enjoyed strong support in the vast rural portions of the state. In St. Louis, however, thousands of German-American immigrants stood true to the Union. Samuel Langhorne Clemens, a.k.a. Mark Twain, who served a brief stint in a Missouri Confederate militia unit, remembered that in 1861, "Our state was invaded by Union forces," whereupon the secessionist governor, Claiborne Jackson, issued a proclamation to help repel the invader. In fact, Missouri remained a hotbed of real and pseudo-rebel resistance, with more than a few outlaw gangs pretending to be Confederates in order to plunder and pillage. William Quantrill's raiders, including the infamous Frank and Jesse James and other criminals, used the rebel cause as a smokescreen to commit crimes. They crisscrossed the Missouri-Kansas borders, capturing the town of Independence, Missouri, in August 1862, and only then were they sworn into the Confederate Army. Quantrill's terror campaign came to a peak a year later with the pillage of Lawrence, Kansas, where his cutthroats killed more than 150 men. Unionist Jayhawkers, scarcely less criminal, organized to counter these Confederate raiders. John C. Fremont, the pathfinder of Mexican War fame, commanded the Union's Western Department. Responding to the Missouri violence, he imposed martial law in August 1861, invoking the death penalty against any captured guerrillas. Fremont further decreed arbitrarily that any slaves captured from rebel forces were emancipated, providing the pro-secession forces in the border states all the ammunition necessary to push them into the Confederacy. This went too far for Lincoln, who countermanded Fremont's emancipation edict while letting martial law stand. The combatants square off. One of the major questions about the American Civil War period is, why did it take the North 4 long and hard years to finally defeat the South? On the surface, the Yankees seemed to possess most of the advantages: a huge population, a standing army and navy, the vast bulk of American industrial might, and a large and effective transportation system. They also had the powerful causes of union and free soil to inspire and propel their soldiers. Yet the North faced a grim and determined foe, whose lack of men and war materiel was balanced somewhat by an abundance of military leadership and combat expertise. Moreover, the war scenario gave an advantage to the defense, not the offense. The conflict sharply illustrated the predictable results when the Western way of war met its exact duplicate on the field of battle, with each side armed with long-range cannons, new rifles, and even newer breech-loading and repeating weapons. Over the course of 4 years, more than 618,000 men would die, more than the combined military losses of the Revolution, the War of 1812, the Mexican War, the Spanish-American War, Korea, and the 20th century's two world wars combined. Gettysburg alone, in 3 bloody days, saw 50,000 killed, wounded, or missing. Sharpsburg, or Antietam, itself, produced more casualties than the Revolution, the War of 1812, and the Mexican War put together. Worse, these were Americans fighting Americans. Stories of brother fighting brother abound. Mary Lincoln's 3 brothers all died fighting for the Confederacy, while Varina Davis, Jefferson Davis's second wife, had relatives in blue. John Crittenden's sons each held the rank of colonel, but in opposing armies. David Farragut, the hero of Mobile Bay, had lived in Virginia, and Lincoln himself was born in Kentucky, a slave state. Robert E. Lee had a nephew commanding a Union squadron on the James River. Union General George McClellan preferred letting the South go. Sam Houston, the governor of Texas, wanted the South to stay in the Union. As young boys, future presidents Theodore Roosevelt, New York, and Woodrow Wilson, Georgia, prayed for divine blessings, but Roosevelt prayed for the North and Wilson for the South. The forces of the Union seemed